Well, the tribe want Dr. Franz Cronier back on BizNews TV, and the tribe have got Dr. Franz Cronier back on BizNews TV this morning. He's with us in person, and we'll be picking up on, well, a host of issues that we haven't covered since we last spoke. Yo, Franz, it's what do you guys say in the political world? A week can be a lifetime. It feels like the past couple of months in South Africa have been just taking us into a different century almost.
Yeah, well, it does mean that society is changing, you know, and on the whole, again, if you consider that public opinion is in the main moderate and centrist, as we've stressed so many times, that the change process is peaceful but chaotic. You know, societies change violently or peacefully. We're in the minority of emerging markets that change peacefully. That where the state retreats, we see massive private sector entry, macro level entry from rooftop solar to road freight to the security industry, mitigating the consequences. It's the pace of change is lightning fast. But in many respects, the trajectory of that change is in the greater scheme of things and relative to other post-colonial emerging markets. You can make the case that it's a finely balanced position and perhaps still one balanced towards the upside.
Mm. There's so much for us to pick up on. Lieutenant General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi being top of that list, Trump tariffs just around the corner. But if society is changing so much, why would it really matter to Johannesburg if Helen Zille were to throw her hat in the ring and, as she says, she wants to, and become the mayor there? Can she make that much of a difference if we are moving in this direction towards almost privatization of so many parts of society?
You know, Alec, at first, when we became aware of this, I thought, yeah, maybe, you know, Johannesburg's difficult. Zille's such an important figure inside the DA. Is she kind of trading down, and what would the implications of that be? Well, we've jettisoned all that thinking. We have another view on this now, that this is the biggest political chess move in the country in more than a decade. And should she, the elections are likely early 2027. So she's got a good year plus on the campaign trail in Johannesburg. Johannesburg is not in a good place. It's deteriorating. The city government is not able to arrest that deterioration. The provincial government is not able to arrest the deterioration either. And should Helen Zille over the next year be able to position her campaign in Johannesburg in such a way that she wins the city with a majority, because that's important, in the local elections, likely early 2027, and then, which she is capable of, lead a process over the next year or 18 months to stage some kind of recovery in the city, which isn't difficult given how far it's fallen. Based on our understanding of a lot of other data, we think that achievement will be perhaps the thing that breaks a big block of the ANC vote for the DA come the election in 2029. Because it will be such a visible demonstration. Should she win and should she turn it around? So lots of shoulds, long time to go. We can talk about the prospects. But should those two events happen, the public demonstration of it in Gauteng, the economic center, the home of the aspirant middle class, this once dominant ANC kind of a peri-urban voting market, the demonstration of that may be sufficient to break a big block of the ANC. And where the two parties are currently positioned at the moment, the figures are DA in the mid to high 20s, the ANC back at just around 40, just below, just above 40. Let this chain of events play out. You can easily see that ANC number move low into the 30s, maybe even below that. And you could easily see the DA number jump up into the mid to high 30s and perhaps even a rival of 40s. As an extreme outcome, you get an election result in 2029. That's the flip of what we had in 2024. DA 20-something, low mid-20s, ANC nearly 40. This time the DA near 40 and the ANC in the low to mid-20s. And I don't think anyone who's observed South Africa's electoral swings of late and is acquainted with the data, and particularly the distress of the ANC's formerly kind of homogenous voting bloc about the performance of their party, it would be a really bold thing to say that that cannot happen. And the inflection point that might set it off, and probably the only one, is the degree to which Mrs. Zille is successful in her Johannesburg campaign, should her party choose her to be their mayoral candidate.
What an interesting insight. And I guess the fact that Helen Zille is the best person in the DA by a country mile, and when you want in business to turn something, a hopeless situation around, you send your best people. You don't send the B team. I guess that would also support it.
You know, she's the toughest person. I mean, very few people would take on the idea of Johannesburg. I can tell you that. I know that. And she's tough enough. And you know what starts to happen in Johannesburg, if you read deep into that political data, you can see it, is the hierarchy of priorities is shifting. And Helen's toughness becomes an asset, because you might think she's a controversial figure. You might think she says things that you know, you might not always agree with. There are people like that. But the fact that she's got that toughness and determination, when you don't have water every week, you can't bath at regular intervals, when the electricity is all over the place, the weeds in places of 5 foot high in the intersections, traffic lights don't work, or there are huge holes, trenches in the roads, you know, that starts to matter less. And you might start to say to yourself, you know, we might not always like the idea of Helen Zille. So it's not my view, it's a view of other people. But, you know, she's got this toughness and determination. That actually becomes an asset for her. And you saw that, in fact, already when the idea was first floated in the media that she might be the DA's mayoral candidate, a very interesting thing happened. Because her typical critics in the slightly left-of-center mainstream media were not vicious in their negativity and rejection of the idea. And a number of them actually welcomed it. And the reason they welcomed it is because they live in Johannesburg and they see it. And that's the thing we're going to have to factor into our estimates. To what extent has the distress of Johannesburg's aspirant established, and the DA's got a lot of the established middle class, but the aspirant voting market on the fringe, of the city on the fringe of the middle class, to what extent is the hierarchy of need shifting to where what was once the sort of knee-jerk rejection of the idea of Helen Zille shifts to a grudging respect for the fact that she's tough enough and she might actually turn the place around. And on that point, probably as much as anything else, turns the result. And if the result is what I've suggested, and it's not there at the moment, she'll need to close a 10-plus points gap to get an outright majority. 10-plus point gap, 10-plus, not 10. So it's a long way to go. But as I said, anyone who observed the results in 2024 will know that 10-plus point gaps are now the kinds of gaps that are flipped in South African elections. And it is perfectly plausible that happens in Gauteng. If it happens and she's successful, then potentially what that does, it breaks the big ANC block. And you have a real race come 2029. And remember also, come 2029, Mr. Ramaphosa is not there for the ANC. And he's a very important factor for otherwise distressed, let's call them distressed ANC voters. are voters who have a deep and long association with the party, who are very appreciative of what it did in the liberation of the country, and initially in terms of governance and raising living standards and creating opportunities for many citizens that didn't previously have, and are therefore distressed at not voting for the party. If they lose the influence that Mr. Ramaphosa has on their voting decision, the ANC is in deeper trouble. You know, we test from time to time favorability scores of politicians, and there's no one in the running for the ANC race, and I've no idea who its next leader will be, but no one on the bill at the moment that comes anywhere near the level of popular of favorability that Mr. Ramaphosa commanded. And in fact, as I sit here thinking about it now, and under a correction, but I think I'm correct. I think in almost all the data we've got, Helen Ziller is a much more popular figure than anyone who might realistically come to lead the ANC after Cyril Ramaphosa. So, my first thoughts that what is she kind of stepping down into a sort of less important role? Absolutely, we've shifted those, and we now think she's busy with something potentially very important.
Well, we've started on the long term, and that's a very good place to start. But on the short term, South Africa's got some major issues that we need to address and discuss and get your insights on, Frans, starting with General Mkhwanazi's bombshell press conference.
Yeah, I mean, we puzzled our way to a point that we understand broadly the factions involved and who's allied to whom in this. And that's not as important as the broader point that, you know, James Myburgh, who once was your colleague and is now mine and is such an absolutely brilliant observer of South Africa, did 25 years ago this really prescient work on cadre deployment and suggesting that, you know, the political consequences would be damaging in the fullness of time. And I reckon there are quite a few kind of middle-of-the-road okay ANC leaders today who would reread James's analyses of all those years ago and say, hell, you know, we wish we'd had a professional broadly civil service broadly, but also security establishment, because to a very great extent what you're seeing is the political battle inside the ANC being fought in the civil service and by extension now in the security services as well. And if you wish to understand what has happened here, that is a good place to begin your understanding.
So it's factional. Mkhwanazi has been promoted as a blemish-free cop, a real good cop. You know the part, many parties. You know the inside story on most issues. What's the
youth society's change? The youth society's change. Well, I'm not going to go there on Mkhwanazi yet, but I mean broadly, our understanding, and you've got to think very carefully. You've got to get this right. Is the minister of police is quite nicely allied to Mr. Ramaphosa. But the commissioner of police, the national commissioner, is, let's say, an adversary of the minister. And the General Mkhwanazi is possibly to an extent an ally of the commissioner. And the ANC has a problem with malfeasance in the broader sense. And these are the security services that have been investigating aspects and angles of that. And I think some of those investigations reached a point where it forced the hands of certain people. And I imagine that's about as far as our understanding extends. And I'm sure in the fullness of time, and more of the details will come out. But the essential, that's the soap opera of it, you know, and it's interesting in its own right. But the important point is that if you don't have a politically neutral civil service, a professional civil service that serves any comers, but instead spend 30 years stressing the fact that you will see your party take control of the levers of power and influence as the sort of revolutionary ideology dictates, then this is one of the consequences that you end up with. Partisan individuals, and I'm not saying that's General Nkwanazi, but the partisan individuals in very influential positions, and read that against the extent of the corruption, and it becomes obvious what the political implications of that would be for the governing administration.
And thanks for the reminder to go and read the brilliant Dr. James Myburgh's piece on CADA deployment. I was very fortunate to have been able to support him a little in the way that he's put together a Politics Web, which really is a go-to website for many people. I have the hugest admiration for him. As now I see you say he's a partner of yours, so well done to you for spotting this incredibly talented person. Moving on to the other issue. And that is August 1, Donald Trump, 40% tariffs on South Africa, the 30 plus 10 for being a member of BRICS. And now Jonas not even being allowed into our chief negotiator, if you like, not even being allowed into the United States. What gives there, Franz?
Well, look, it's an absurd and tragic situation. You had my colleague, Becky Maklobo, on, who spends a lot of his life in the United States. And my experience and that of Becky's are similar. That the Americans desire a fantastic trade and investment deal with South Africa, and they've got good reasons for that. One is they're not quite where they should be in terms of fixed investment into Southern Africa. Some of their global rivals might be getting a bit ahead of them. Southern Africa is important. You know, Africa's got more cities now of 1 million inhabitants than Europe and America combined. It's the last untapped consumer market in the world. It's the answer to the global protein crisis. It's 50 votes on global fora, and we're not even at the sort of cliche issues like critical minerals. It's also strategically important. I've gone through that with you before, our arguments about the Indo-Pacific and Simonstown and the back door to the South Atlantic. So it's not in a multipolar world, you don't want to surrender a choke point like Simonstown to your adversary. So the Americans are motivated. My experience of them is they say that, look, South Africa is an absolutely eminently investable place for us because it's the sort of place that expatriates would want to go and live. You know, an American executive is not going to take their family to live on the outskirts of Goma in the DRC. But, you know, you can say to your spouse, oh, well, we'll go live in Constantia or Hermanus. And that's just a better standard of living than anything you had in the U.S. So South Africa is eminently investable. So some of the sort of forward-thinking Americans are also very bullish on what South Africa could be. You know, if they back us on refurbishing the coal plants, which they'll do, and they'll fight off these, I think, very disappointing Europeans who insist that we maintain a very high level of poverty and unemployment amongst black people via the shutting down of our best electricity and energy resources. They could partner in the refitment of the, here's an argument, they repartner in the refitment of the coal fleet. That's easy. It takes 2-3 years. We now have a vast surplus of electricity. That makes the steel industry viable again. Not many places in the world that have the chrome, the manganese, and the iron ore in one place and an electricity surplus. If you get the steel going again, that opens the door to the very necessary infrastructure rebuilds and refitments that American firms can partner with South African firms to do. And those partnerships can in turn lead to, you know, much new life into everything from commercial agriculture through to mining. And on the back of that, the partnerships can help American companies get into the rest of Africa. It's not easy if you're an American investor to go and mine in the DRC because it's a kind of place, it's a bit of child labor, it's violent, it's difficult, you easily fall foul of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the U.S. So they see this amazing future for the two sides to work together. But the American side then makes an argument, or some of them, as I've heard it, that says, look, your country's got all this potential, but you're a 1% growth economy at the moment, less than that. and you've got a 30% unemployment rate, and your politics is really wild. And, you know, if we add those three things together, you're not really that investable at the moment, because it could go wrong, whether they're right in that or not. That's a fair assessment. And they then go further and they say, why is it that your economy grows at 1%? And the reason is that they'd agree that our big sort of standing point of the year, South Africa's fixed investment level is half the emerging market average. That's why the economy grows at 1% and not at 4%. And their argument goes further. Why do you not draw that investment? And they say, well, listen, you guys are taxing capital on arrival in the form of BEE. And it's not a criticism of empowerment policy or that we shouldn't have it, or we're not open to it, or equity equivalence or corporate social investment schemes or doing a lot to try and lift the quality of maths education or bursaries or better schools or whatever it takes. It's just that if you it's a tariff. To say that if an American company wishes to invest, it has to cede X percent. So we'd like an exemption for American firms that we can invest. Otherwise, we just can't. Second point the Americans make is to say, look, I speak as from the American perspective, is that your expropriation law allows the seizure of any fixed or movable asset for less than its market value. And you guys got to say you have a reputation for a little bit of kind of corruption and malfeasance. So you want us to sink capital in, be taxed on it, and then be in a position where whoever comes to govern the country one day can take the asset away. You're just not competitive. So rework that stuff. And that's what the South African media portrays as America's demands. And I don't think that's the right term at all. I think you should hear these guys out and what they have to say. Now, on the South African side, the American view is that the South Africans are just not showing up with a deal. And what they talk about, a little bit of gas maybe and a little bit of this, is small stuff. It's not a scale of thinking that takes your country back to 3 or 4 or 5% growth. And Becky and I have done the estimates that if the US wants to close its fixed investment gap on China and Southern Africa, and the quantum of dollars that it would need to sink into the continent, let's say over the next decade, and a lot of that will be sunk into South Africa for the Constantia reason. The quantum they'd sink in will in and of itself be sufficient to raise the fixed investment level from the current 15% to north of 20 and then on its way to 25, which automatically takes the growth rate to 3 or 4%. But we don't have an ambassador in Washington. We don't have around an ambassador a team of really brilliant youngsters who are rocking up at every policy seminar, every congressional hearing. When they're not doing that, they're walking the halls of the congressional office buildings, making the case for South Africa. We don't have any of that. And even this envoy idea hasn't gone down well with the Americans. And so we're not, the deal isn't happening because we are not there. And what's the, I'm sort of, a client of mine would say, how is this possible? And our answers become, look, if you're a domestic South African firm or something, you've got experience of this too. How the slowness with which the ANC moved on reform ahead of last year's election for the 5 years before that cost them the entire election. So there is a pattern of behavior where this current administration under Mr. Ramaphosa has been unable to move with any kind of determination to seize opportunities that are to the vast advantage of even his own party and his government. And then my last point, and I'll stop for you, I've told you about the sort of the DA's route to final victory, as it were, through Helen Zille. But the ANC has a much easier task to get back to high 50, 60%. If ahead of 2029, all that it does is to raise the country's growth rate to 2.5 or 3%, I'm confident sitting here and telling you that it will win the 2029 election outright. And the shortest cut to do that is to come to terms with the Americans, which we're not doing because we're not showing up.
Are we not showing up because we don't know how to? We don't understand the rules of the game, and you know, the kind of follow on from that is, what about South Africans as a whole? You are the chair of the Social Research Foundation. You do a lot of polling of how people think about what's happening in the world and what's happening in particular in South Africa. Are Joe Public South Africa starting to make that connection between bad politics and no jobs?
Of course, yes. That's why the election was lost last year, because South Africans are centrist and moderate and think for themselves, and they vote, as I've probably said 100 times on your show, because it's an important point, they vote on their material circumstances, not on ideological or other fixations. And in as far as the, let's call it the lethargy towards reform, has had the effect that people's lives haven't improved. They have made different political decisions. And the fact that I think we're kind of serious analysts that can sit here with you and suggest something as extreme as that Helen Ziller's arrival in Johannesburg can completely flip the political script in the country. She only has that gap because the ANC has been slow towards the reforms necessary to raise the rate of firstly, confidence, and thereby fixed investment, and thereby growth, and thereby jobs, because these indicators feed one off the other in a very predictable way. So the deal's out. I mean, the positive is, you know, the positive of it is the deal's out there, and it's easy to do. Easiest thing in the world to do. It really is not difficult. And I asked a colleague who's let's say, I don't think very involved in this, a colleague, not really a colleague, a associate, a acquaintance. And I said to him, look, even if we screw this up now as the South African side, is that the end, or can we show up any time and say, listen, we don't know what we were doing, but we'd really like to talk. And his answer was actually quite positive. The answer was, no, if you guys show up seriously with a serious offer, then absolutely. We'd be, you know, the answer suggests that the door remains open. Although the consequences in the interim are, yeah, well, 30% tariffs. Maybe we get a bonus for BRICS. And I see the Brazilians are getting 50 because of Bolsonaro. So you never know what might be in store for us. But this really is the easiest thing in the world to avoid and evade. And if we just avoid and evade it, the upsides for us as the country, for people, for their lives, for poverty, for jobs, and ultimately for the ANC's own survival are absolutely obvious.
The motor industry is finally seemingly woken up, and now we're getting motor industry executives talking about this, but that's got to be an area that is really going to be taking a lot of strain. At 40% tariffs, agriculture as well. Would that be enough of a shock to those in Pretoria, the Pretoria Plonkers FC, as I called them yesterday, to wakey-wakey and get down off their high horses and realize that the coffee is strong and it's finally been smelled?
I don't know, Alec. If you weren't even motivated to move to save yourselves from an election defeat. And remember, we had such a nice vantage point on that because we saw the defeat come. So we were able to tell people there's a defeat coming. If not even that prospect could move you, then I don't know what does move you. And look, the 30% tariffs, the key thing we send to art is valuable metals. So the PGMs, those can be redirected to America. Those can be redirected elsewhere. That's fine. Agriculture, to a certain extent, gets into trouble, but should have seen that coming in the longer run. And makes sense to diversify and just to put a lot of pressure also, which hasn't always been done, on the South Africans to get their act together. And organized agriculture in South Africa made a terrible mistake several months ago when they came out with a series of absolutely hardline attacks on Trump and the Trump administration. And they noticed that. And so they're not going to arrive in Washington expecting any favors because of the way they responded to some of Trump's initial stuff. And I'm afraid you have to play the game. And cars, let's just stop at cars for a second. It's a project that many in the government think is very important, but would losing the car industry, if that is now the inevitable trajectory of things, and it's not just because of these tariffs, the tariffs have just accelerated that. Is that a bad thing for the country's economy, or is it a boost? Because we maintain very high tariff levels on car imports. The price of cars in South Africa are higher than they need to be in order to sustain our domestic auto industry. And an argument I think is worth considering is that because we have the strange urban geography that we inherited from apartheid, we don't have public transport systems, and used cars are so very expensive, small-scale entrepreneurs that are trying to start a little business, you know, it could be recycling or building or whatever it is, cannot afford the transport link from where they live to where they do business because cars are absurdly expensive. If we lost our auto industry and therefore the tariffs that on imported vehicles, and we particularly if we then open the door to the import of cheap Asian second-hand vehicles, which the roads might become more dangerous, but I'm pretty certain that let's put it this way, that the PGM metals to America, those will be redirected. The aspects of agriculture, they're going to have a bit of a tough time. The loss of the auto industry in the fullness of time might well be a net benefit to the country's economy. We could grow faster and be better off. Even this 30%, it doesn't change the category of country that South Africa is. It's not as if we were an economy growing at 2.5% and now because of these tariffs we're down to 1. We were a country growing at sub 1%. Abeki's very excellent estimate. He's one of the few economists that hasn't altered his South Africa growth forecast. He's still at sub 1% since the beginning of the year. We're still going to be a sub 1% economy. We might just shave that sub 1 to a little bit less than what it was. But a category change of country is not something these Americans are bringing about, because the problems in our economy and the socioeconomic consequences are not to any extent a consequence of what someone outside did to us. They are a consequence of the tariffs that we applied to our own economy in terms of being hostile to fixed investment, hostile to investor confidence, and artificially raising the prices of goods and services to an extent that might easily have been avoided. But yeah, then you pay a political price and the politics reforms, yeah.
Non-tariff barriers. I'm glad you brought that up, France, about the motor industry. We do pay 30% more for vehicles in this country to subsidize the export of vehicles, which in itself seems a little strange. So maybe there's a silver lining to this particular cloud, at least as far as the motor industry is concerned. Dr. France Cronier is the founder and a director at France Cronier Private Clients. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.